starting point that I'd like to make is a theological starting point. Then I'd like to give you a practical model of how to have a second career. And this comes out of my own experience, and I'll use myself first of all as a model. And then I'd like to, thirdly, open it up for you and give you some hints from my own experience on how to have a second career for yourself. I'm not a businessman primarily. I'm a pastor, and I carry on a full-time ministry at Lutheran Church of the Risen Lord in Odessa, Texas. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Sam Urata. And it's not Murata, it's Urata. And it's very hard to catch, and it's very hard to say. And it's Sam, S-A-M. I should go by my given name, which is Salvador. And then it wouldn't be quite as hard. Salvador Urata would be a lot easier to understand. So up here, maybe I can change my name. Paul changed his name from Saul to Paul. Maybe I can change mine back from my nickname, Sam, to Salvador. And you may all, as you leave, kiss my ring and genuflect, because Salvador in Italian means Savior. And there are some very definite theological bases for having a second career. And these are not a part of the sacramental order. They're a part of the natural order of things that God has ordained. And these are very separate things, and yet they're all a part of theology. They're all a part of what God has given us to enjoy in life. There's a very definite need in our lives today, especially in the 20th century, for some unity and some balance in our lives. By unity, I mean not following every new fad that comes along and looking for a variety of experiences, which is one of the very definite needs that we have as human beings. And a psychologist named Murray Banks has pointed this out to me, that one of the four basic needs of mankind is a need for variety. And instead of having variety in life, our occupations tend to make us have only one purpose and one goal in life. There was a movie called The Longest Yard that many of you probably saw. Story, Burt Reynolds starred in it, of a pro football player who got in some trouble. He was sent to prison, and while he was in prison, he organized a semi-pro team to play against the semi-pro team of the warden. And as Burt Reynolds was getting drunk in the film inside the prison, one of his friends had some connections and got some wine. And Reynolds was getting drunk, and he and the other fellow were talking together. Reynolds said, "You know, my problem is that I've always had my crap together." And he put it in a vernacular like the kids put it. And then he said, I think, a very pointed thing. He said, "I've never been able to carry it." And I think this is a problem with 20th century society. Many people do have their crap together, you know, got their stuff together. But it's just too heavy a burden for them to carry. And your unity, I think, needs to come not only out of your occupational experience, but your unity needs to come out of the variety of experiences that God gives you. And your unity comes in having a central focus in your life in Jesus Christ. And so I think it's a part of the very nature of mankind and of mankind's existence that we do need a center. But I think we have the wrong center when the center of our lives is our occupation. The center of our lives, and every Christian needs to have his vocation, his calling in Jesus Christ. And then our avocation is really what we do, the job that we perform. I could play a little game with us in here if we had enough time, and if the group were small enough, you know, we could ask everybody who you are. And if I would ask Norm, who are you? Norm would tell me, my name is Norm. I don't know his last name. And tell me a little bit about yourself. Norm would say, I'm a dentist. When I'm asked, who are you? I say, my name is Sam Urata, Salvador Urata, Jr. And I am a pastor. But that's not really describing who I am. That's telling what I do in life. And I think we need to have the center of our attention be in Jesus Christ. And then really our avocation is what our physical calling is to be, our job. But you need to have unity in your life. And then you need to have not only unity, but some balance. And by balance, I mean not having all your eggs in one basket. And I think occupationally, we're forced today to have all of our eggs in one basket. When you're trained for a career, you're not trained for many careers, you're trained for a single career. And everything, most of what you do in school is aiming toward giving you a proficiency in a given occupation. And even though we study in liberal arts colleges today, why do you study grammar? You study grammar so you can communicate well in your occupation. Why do you study literature? You study it, you know, in relation to an occupation, a major that you have. And I think this is a bad influence when we train only for one vocation in life, one avocation. And so I think we need to have some balance in our lives. And you can have not only an imbalance in your life, in your vocation, you can have it in almost any area of your life. My wife tells me that I love life. And she says, I love it too much to be a pastor. And I've just got too many interests. I had a personal experience with this in an aunt who lived with us in our home. My dad served in World War II. We had a large house in New Orleans. My uncle, for some reason, was exempt from military service. And he and my aunt lived with us. And so I knew him very intimately, almost as mother and father, as well as aunt and uncle. I remember very distinctly in 1952, we took a vacation to Pikes Peak in Colorado, Colorado Springs. And I remember my folks thinking that I was asleep. I remember hearing as my mother had called home and she came back in and she said that my aunt and my uncle were getting a divorce. And it wasn't too long after that my aunt began to drink. And she began to drink rather heavily. And my uncle did get a divorce. He had found another woman and had married that woman. And my uncle died of a heart attack at about age of 48. And I remember going to the funeral with my aunt. And she was very torn up about it, even though he had remarried. And 8 days later, she drank herself to death. And she had only one purpose in life. And she had an imbalance in her life. And that imbalance, and that's an extreme example, but it's a true example. My aunt didn't die of a duodenal ulcer. She didn't die of a physical cause. She died of a broken heart. And she died of an imbalance in her life. So we need to have a balance in our lives. That's an extreme example, I realize that. But I think it's an example that can drive us to an early grave too. So you need to maintain in your life not only a unity in Jesus Christ and having a place where you can get it all together. And when your burden's too heavy, of course, you can remember the words of Jesus, "Come unto me, all ye who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And so we have a unity in Jesus Christ, and we need to have a balance in our lives, a good, healthy balance between work and worship and play. These are the three things that God has made mankind for. And in the Old Testament, before mankind had even sinned, God gave mankind a job to do. And that's another story in itself. And I discovered this as I was doing some preparation for Bible study on a course in marriage. And you get some time, go back, and I had read that story 1,000 times in Genesis where it's quoted in our hymnal. God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make an helper fit for him." There was a good chuckle around the campfire because God played a joke on mankind. Because God told mankind to go around and check all the animals out and give them names. And this was man's work in the Garden of Eden. And at the end of this story it says, "And still there was not found a helper fit for man. And then God made woman." And I'm sure in the Old Testament that was a bit of humor, and as the story of Genesis and creation of woman was told, that it gave at least a smile to people's faces as they realized the little joke that God played on man when he said, go around and check all the animals out first and see if there's a helper who's fit for you here. And when God finally does create woman, man says, aha, this at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, you know, and the helper that God had made for him. Then after the fall into sin, God said that mankind no longer would be able to eat of the goodies in the Garden of Eden, but that he would have to earn his daily bread by the sweat of his brow. So work is a part of God's plan for creation before a fall for mankind, and also after a fall into sin. It also became man's curse after a fall into sin. And we live under that curse of work. God also made mankind not only for work, but he made him for worship, to be in communion with God and to be in communication with God. And this is what worship really is, to live in an attitude of gratitude, to use the old phrase, an attitude of thankfulness, an attitude of conversation, an attitude of having your spirit be in tune with the Spirit of God. And that is our true worship, and that we do just on Sunday morning. There, in the Old Testament, between God and Adam and Eve, there are no worship services where Adam and Eve meet God and sing God's praise in a ritualistic form. And so the true worship doesn't come in what we do on Sunday morning, but in our communion with God throughout the week. Work and worship and play was a very important part of what God made mankind for. Probably in the Old Testament, I think I remember studying that there are almost as many holy days and feast days in the Old Testament as there are work days. And of course, God gave the commandments. 6 days God had worked. On the seventh day, God took off and goofed off, and God said that in the third commandment that we should also remember his Sabbath day to keep it holy. That's God's plan, work, worship, and play. But unfortunately, in 20th century society, we've gotten these things confused. And instead of working at our work, we worship our work. And work becomes the sole reason for our existence, our occupation that we carry out. And it's work that really gives meaning to our lives. And the only reason that we play in 20th century society is so we can go back and do our jobs better. And you're here on vacation at Holden Village, and you're away from your work, and you say, boy, when I get back to civilization, I'm really going to be able to put out because I've really had an enjoyable and restful time at Holden Village. And so work becomes the sole reason for our being. And play becomes a handmaiden of work instead of being right within itself. So we worship our work in 20th century America. Then we work at our play. And if you've been here at Holden Village for a short period of time, you've probably worn yourself out playing because you've run up to Holden Lake, you've tried to run up to Hart Lake and been carried away by flies. I've demythologized the ascension of Jesus. What really happened was the Mount of Ascension was probably near the sanitary landfill in Jerusalem. And being here at Holden Village, Jesus was probably carried up by flies into a cloud of flies. I think that would be a good demythologization of the ascension of Jesus. You've probably run up to mine and just constantly had to be doing something, you know. That's the way we work in Odessa. We're right in the middle of everything in Odessa, Texas. You wouldn't believe it by looking at the landscape, but there's skiing, there's fishing, there's boating, you name it, and we're right exactly in the middle of it. 250 miles west of us, you can go to Ruidoso and go skiing. 250 miles east of us or south of us, there's water for fishing and for water skiing. And so on Friday afternoons, Friday evenings, you see people headed out from Odessa, and they are going to have fun at their play, you know, and they've got the boat hitched behind the car, camper hitched behind the car. And the man who is just come from work has his hat, and he's got it pulled down over his ears, and he's behind the wheel of the car. The wife has had to prepare all week to come out and go out on a weekend and have fun. The kids are in the back seat and they're raising all sorts of cane, and the dad's sitting behind a wheel and he's tense and he says, "Shut up, kids! Shut up, wife! I don't want to hear what you left behind. We're going out this weekend and we're going to have fun if it kills us, you know?" And you can see him straggling back in on Sunday night, you know, just completely exhausted from the weekend and looking forward to Monday morning when they can get back to work. Ah, just absolutely exhausted from their play. They've really had to work at it. And then the third thing that we've confused is our worship. And what's left, of course, is to play at our worship. What do you do when you're small and you play? You dress up. You get it in mommy and daddy's clothes, and you have a script. You act out the script that mommy and daddy act out during the week. And so what do? On Sunday morning when we come to worship, we put on our play clothes. Only thing there are dress clothes. You know, you dress up in a suit, a tie. How about your pastor, or if you are a pastor? What do? You put on your robes. How many times during the week do you walk around in your robes? You know, people would say it's okay to walk around in a collar, but if you walk around in your vestments, people would say, uh-huh, you know, there's a candidate for a funny farm. So we put on our play clothes. And not only that, but we even have a script before us. It's called the Divine Worship Service in our hymnal. And so everybody comes together, and when you play, you sing. And so we sing a little bit, we listen to a little music, and we dress up, and we have our worship service. And so really, what we need to do is to straighten out our attitudes toward work and worship and play and put them back in their proper perspective. That really, I think, is one of the most important parts of a second career. Straightening out in your own mind relationship of work and worship and play. Then, as far as second career is concerned, when we're sort of Calvinistic in our ideas about work, we have an idea that we are destined in the will of God to have one occupation. And I think we are far away from a biblical understanding of work and a biblical understanding of abilities. And we tend to think of the will of God in our lives as being something very definite and very clear-cut. And we have no choice in the matter. Or if we make a bad choice in choosing an occupation or an avocation, then you've really screwed up your life. And so if you're meant to go into ministry and you choose another occupation, you've gone against the will of God and you're going to have an unhappy life. Maybe there are some of you who have planned for a career and been forced because of economic circumstances to have a different career than the one that you had originally planned on. Maybe you've had to make a decision, and the decision that you've made you felt has been a bad one. And you look back at life and say, if only I had chosen the other road, if only I hadn't gotten married, if only I hadn't been forced to go to work at an early age and miss out on a college education, then I would be happy. Now I'm unhappy. God does not give us one talent or one ability. I have yet to meet a person who has been limited in their choice of vocation to one specific thing. Rather, I think God gives us like he gives us in nature, a great variety of nature around us. And you look around us, and I'm constantly amazed at the tremendous waste that God has given so that we might enjoy very little. And I think the human personality is just like it. You know, how many flowers did God put around in the meadows as we walked up to Holden Lake? I thought of it yesterday. We stopped a couple of times to enjoy flowers that were very close to us. How many flowers were back off the trail that we really didn't see, but God gave us those flowers that we could see and enjoy, the ones that were up close? And the waste that God has, the lavish way that God's given us nature, just poured it out upon us. And when it comes to human personality, we limit ourselves to one specific thing when there's no need to limit ourselves to one specific thing. God's made us multi-talented people, and there are a variety of things that you could do that you could be happy doing. And so when it comes to talents and abilities, I can use myself as an example. I've been a pastor and carried on, I think, a tremendous ministry. I've really enjoyed it and had an excellent time in my ministry. I've only had one time in the 10 years that I've been a pastor when I've really had any serious doubts, when I've really run into any serious problems, and this was partly immaturity on my own part and partly rigidity on the part of a church council president that I had, who didn't see things my way, and we had conflict for quite a while. In the end, God bore me out, and this man wanted to show his contempt for me, and when his daughter was getting married, instead of asking me to marry his daughter, instead of having his daughter ask me to marry her, he went and very proudly announced that his old pastor from Taylor, Texas, was going to perform the wedding ceremony. And he asked me if they could use the church, you know, with the smirk on his face. And I said, sure, you can use the church. You know, have at it. You're welcome to it. It's your church. It's not mine. And, of course, you're welcome to have your daughter's wedding in the church. Well, a man from Taylor had to cancel out for some reason. And so he went back to another pastor, and I wasn't even his second choice, and he wasn't going to let me perform the ceremony for his daughter's wedding. And so he made the big announcement a second time that someone else was going to perform the ceremony, and the second man had to cancel out after he had already accepted. And so there was one day when the man asked me, called me and asked if he could come into my office, and he had his tail between his legs and his ears were drooping low, and he came in and he said, would you perform the wedding ceremony for my daughter? And I thought, oh, how sweet revenge is And I really had an opportunity to let him have it, and I did. And the way I chose to do it, though, was a God-given way. And I told him that I would be happy to perform the wedding ceremony for his daughter. And so it all worked out well. But that was one of the low points of my ministry, and that went on for approximately 3 years when he and I had a running battle together, and it was one of the tough times of my ministry. I felt kind of locked in to the ministry. It was what I had been trained for. It was my chosen occupation in life. And there were times when I was very unhappy during that particular time in my ministry. I was fortunate to have a two-point parish, and I had another church council president and another church that responded to me and God's proclamation of the gospel through me. So I was never at a point where I was let down by God. I was always buoyed up by the second congregation as opposed to one man within the other congregation. But then I began to realize that God had given me other talents and that there were other things that I could do, other jobs that I could perform. And I had collected coins as a youngster. I worked and I was in a very fortunate position. You may have seen me running around here with the original Brunning sweatshirt, t-shirt on. And it says, since 1859, and my family has owned a restaurant in New Orleans since 1859. And I began to realize that as I was growing up, I had performed many jobs within my family's restaurant. When I was too young to do anything else, we used to get our ice in 50-pound blocks, and we had an ice pick that had many prongs on it, and I would shave ice for the waitresses and put ice in the glasses. And I must have been maybe 3 or 4 years old at the time. Then I started as a busboy, and made the fantastic sum of 25 cents an hour working for my dad as a busboy. And I graduated to being a dishwasher. And from there, it was about that time that my aunt passed away. And at 14 years of age, I became a cashier. And then at 16 years of age, I became a bartender. So I began to realize that there were a lot of things that I could do if I wanted to get out of the ministry. It was during this time that I began to recultivate an interest in coins. My grandmother, my mother's mother, had started a small coin accumulation. At that time in Louisiana, the state police and our sheriff in our parish or county began to look the other way as far as gambling was concerned. And so in our restaurant, we had 200 slot machines. And slot machines needed repair. And there were a lot of people who would put foreign coins in the slot machines, a lot of people who would put tokens into slot machines. And all of the foreign coins and tokens that came out of the slot machines, my grandmother would save in a little cigar box. And I spent many pleasant hours as a youngster going through that cigar box and sorting out the coins, or any old coin that would come through, she would put in the cigar box also. When I worked as a cashier during the winter, our business was very slow, and so I bought some Whitman coin boards and began to fill those coin boards out of the cash register. And I remember very distinctly, in 1950, they made a nickel in Denver, and only in Denver, and the mintage was very short. And we get all our coinage in New Orleans from Denver Mint. And I remember we got quite a few rolls of 1950D nickels. And at that time, they were worth a nickel apiece, fresh out of the Denver Mint. So I stuck one in my coin board, and I remember throwing rolls of those things back in the cash register and handing them out in change. Well, at one time, they were worth $900 a roll. And I think back, you know, just with pain in my heart at all of that money I turned back into circulation. But I began during my ministry, when I got to college, I got interested in girls, I got interested in alcohol, I got interested in sin in a big way, and I forgot about the coin collecting. And then for a few years while we were married, I had adjustments to make in marriage, and so coin collecting went by way. When I got into parish ministry, I found there was a need for another outlet. And so I began to dig back into my coins. And my interest in coin collecting was rekindled. So I began also to discover something that I had discovered before. You could not only buy coins, you could also sell coins and sell them at a profit occasionally if you could find a place to buy them cheap enough and to sell them cheap enough. So I began to make some of the Saturday coin shows, which are held frequently in the spring and again in the fall, and I began to make a little money buying and selling coins, supplementing my income from the church. And it was really enjoyable. It was my day off, and I really found great satisfaction in buying and selling coins, some rare, some common coins, some that people needed to fill coin folders, and some that coin collectors were looking for. I found that not only could I sell to collectors, but if I had bought the coin cheaply enough, I could also sell it to other coin dealers. I always tried to be fair, and I always tried to be honest in my dealings with other people, and this is where it really paid off. I had some integrity, and I would always pay a fair price for a coin and always sell it for a fair price. And so an opportunity came my way 4 years ago in August. I believe it was 4 years ago yesterday that I became, made the step from being an amateur coin dealer to a professional coin dealer. And it came about again, I think, because of integrity in the business. The man who owned Odessa's only coin shop decided that he wanted to sell the coin shop. And he had a manager working for him who was an old man who had retired from the grocery business. The man wanted to make sure, the man who owned the coin shop wanted to make sure that the old man had a job. And so he asked the old man who he wanted him to sell the coin shop to. And so the manager said that if I would buy the coin shop, and if I was in a position to buy it, that he would like to have the owner sell the shop to me. So when he called me one morning and asked me if I was interested in buying the coin shop, I said, figure up what it's going to cost me to buy a shop, and then we'll start to talk about it, because I had thought about buying a shop in Abilene at one time, and the price was just too high. So they figured up what the inventory of the shop was, and if I would buy the inventory of the coin shop would be mine. Well, I figured up an inventory of $7,000. And I was in a position from wheeling and dealing in coins before, and also through my mother, who was willing to take a risk with me to buy the coin shop. I hit it at a very opportune time. This was just before precious metals began a rise in value. And within 3 months, my investment of $7,000 tripled. I also put in $20,000 in inventory that I had in safe deposit boxes and deposited around my house in various places through my trading in coins. My initial investment in coins was zero. And I had started out with pocket change, and within a period of several years built up to a $20,000 inventory at my cost. And when I put my coins into $7,000 inventory, we had a pretty good operation for a coin shop, especially an only shop in town. Then through organization, that was something that the former owner had never done, was to organize a business. And I organized a business. We established buy and sell prices for coins. We established buy and sell prices and a formula for buy and sell prices for bulk coins, which means common date silver coins that have no collector value, but that have an intrinsic value in metal, in precious metals. Silver coins now, any silver coin from 1964 back that doesn't have a collector value has an intrinsic value of approximately 3 to 1 as far as face value is concerned. So if you have a dollar in silver quarters, it's worth approximately in silver value alone $3. And so we established a buy and sell relationship based on the market spot price of silver, which was very easily obtainable through local newspapers, which gave a spot silver price for the previous day, a spot gold price for previous day, and we established a formula. It did take a little time initially on my part as a pastor to set up the coin operation. There were many times when I spent my entire day off down at the coin shop cleaning up, getting things organized so we'd know where a particular coin was if someone came in to buy a coin. We also began to handle supplies, coin supplies, Whitman coin folders, novelty type things, birth year coin holders, so that if grandpa or grandma wanted to buy a present for a newborn baby, they could come in and buy a set of birth year coins, or go back and buy a set of birth year coins for maybe parents, or an anniversary set of coins. And so we began to stock these supplies. We began to stock the necklaces that would hold coins. And we found out that these things were very profitable. So I spent quite a few days off getting the coins and the coin supplies and getting the operation organized. I've got it organized to a point now where it takes me a cup of coffee a day to run my coin shop. My manager does the day-to-day buying. I'm free to come in only on special consultation, maybe to do an estate appraisal, and I charge exactly what the attorney charges. When the attorney calls the coin shop and says that he wants an appraisal made, what will it cost? I'll ask him, what are your figures per hour? And if he tells me $40, $50, I'll say that's what the appraisal will cost. My time, $40 to $50 an hour, because I've got the expertise that he has in a specialized field that needs a specialized field for Internal Revenue Service purposes. So I make estate appraisals, and I'm free to delve into areas that really interest me in coinage. I've always been fascinated by ancient history. My manager has no interest in ancient history. And so I've branched out into a subsidiary of my coin shop, Texas Coins, and I chose name for my subsidiary of Plebeians and Patricians, common ancient coins and ancient coins with a pedigree. And so now I run the operation of Plebeians and Patricians, which takes a very minimal amount of time, and my coin shop manager runs a day-to-day operation. I'm much more interested in the history of coinage and in ancient coinage and tokens and metals than I am in collector-type coins. I've passed that point in my coin collecting stage. So I've been able to apply my interests to my avocation in my coin shop. And so right now I carry on a full-time ministry at Lutheran Church of the Risen Lord. And as most of you pastors know, a full-time ministry involves not a 40-hour week operation. It involves 60, 70, 80, 90 hours a week to be a pastor of a church. And I also am a full-time professional coin dealer, having the coin shop open 6 days a week from 9 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock in the evening with my manager running the operation for me. That's the way that I've gotten involved in coin collecting. I think as far as men are concerned, that we have a definite need for an avocation, a second career, especially when you face the reality of the job that you work at day after day. Even in a field where there's as much variety as there is in the ministry, there also is a boredom that creeps in. And you have just a natural tendency to become bored with your occupation, especially after you've been into it for quite a while. And there's a need for a hobby. And I think everybody ought to have a hobby. I think coin collecting is an excellent hobby for me. I think you have talents that would lead you into another hobby, which could lead into another vocation. Then I think there's, because of the specialized nature of the work that many of us do now, I think there's also a tendency for boredom to creep in after you've been in an occupation for a given number of years, maybe 20 years. There's a need for a change to be made, and you have a need for variety in your life. And so I was talking to Rick before, and he's not yet out of college. Are you, Rick? And he's already planning a second career, and he's been thinking about going into ministry. And as we talked at coffee break, I said, it's not too early to start in a second career for you. And he said he already is thinking about starting in a second career, and he's studying marketing in college. And I think that's a wise decision. Nor is it too late to begin on a second career. There are always areas of interest that you have, and in preparation for retirement, I think one of the best things in preparation for retirement would be the active cultivation of a hobby that may lead into a part-time business and a source of income for you in your retirement. I think people who retire strictly on Social Security could be in serious trouble. And I think the village recognizes this in their giving a special rate to people who are on Social Security. And so not only is it wise mentally to develop a second career, I think economically as you prepare for retirement, it's also wise to prepare for a second career also. Not that I think that there's going to be any big economic crash. I've studied economics and I'm well-versed in precious metals, and I just don't look for a tremendous crash to come. I think, but just economically, it's wise to prepare for some other type of work that you can do. I think women, one reason women suffer fewer heart attacks than men is because women often have second careers. And women often are have a career before they're married, and their second careers become their families, and then maybe they turn after children are grown to another career, and it frees up women. And I think men, we need to strike a blow for men's liberation and begin our second careers also. When I served as a waitress the other day, I announced that they needed help earlier in the week, and I signed up to be a waitry in the dining hall. And I donned my apron like all the other waitry donned their aprons, and I was the only male that I've seen since then who's put an apron on and been a waitry. And somebody asked me why I was doing it, and I said I was striking a blow for men's liberation, you know, and breaking into previously closed ranks of strictly female waitry. So I think men need to develop that interest in a second career. My own example began with an interest, a talent. The interest was there, and then I began to cultivate that interest. The opportunity came along with my grandmother's coin collection for me to, and these came from slot machines and from my grandfather's gambling casino that he had in operation, and that opportunity I cultivated. Then I pursued it, and maybe this was greed on my part and a desire to possess and a desire to have. And there is also another interesting facet in coin collecting. And I always tell my manager, if you can, sell them a coin book, one of the 69-cent Whitman coin folders. Sell them a good book, because there's a psychology in coin collecting and in coin dealing. And it's sort of like the poem, as you go through life, whatever be your goal, keep your eye upon the donut and not upon the hole. And in coin collecting, you may work and fill up almost an entire album, but you don't appreciate the album. You worry about the empty hole in the album. And so I get the coin album sold, and then I know if people are really interested in it, they're going to buy coins to fill the empty holes in their coin albums. So I was one of those who pursued it with greed in my mind. Then the opportunity came in buying the coin shop, and I was willing to take the risk and buy in. I didn't know how it was going to work out. It was bucks or bust as far as $7,000 goes, but I was willing to take the risk, and I think you've got to be willing to take the risk too. And it gave me opportunity to pursue some things that I was really interested in. Okay, how do you go about developing a second career? I think, first of all, you've got to know yourself and to know your own abilities and also to recognize the gifts that you don't have. I think that's very important, to know yourself, to know your own abilities, and to know the areas that your talents do not lie in. We have a woman in our congregation who wants to teach, and she thinks that she would be a good teacher. And she is the world's most boring teacher. When we have women's Bible study and she signs up for a Bible study, nobody shows up for her Bible study. And it's because she'll just bore you absolutely to death. And we have taken her aside a couple of times and told her that she is not a teacher. She's a very literary person. She can put it down with pen on paper and it comes out beautifully. But when it comes to delivering a message, she just is not able to do it. And so we've channeled her into being our church reporter. And she writes all the news releases for our church, and she does a beautiful job of it. Then you need to plan and work from your strengths instead of from your weaknesses. And this is where knowing yourself and your abilities really is important. Don't sit around bemoaning the fact that you're not going to be something. Find out where your strengths are and work from your strengths instead of from your weaknesses. Develop the strengths that you do have. And then the second point in becoming and in developing a second career, I think, is to find a market and match up with your talents with a market. There has to be a marketability of the product that you would produce or the service that you would give. Now, I mentioned before that I think I'm a multi-talented person. I headed originally under pressure from my parents for law school. And I had a scholarship to Louisiana State University in New Orleans, and I missed being an attorney by 2 hours. We had registration at Texas Lutheran College, and I had not yet received my letter of acceptance because Louisiana State Law School started 2 weeks later than Texas Lutheran did, and I hadn't yet received official confirmation to come for the spring semester. And some friends said to me, why don't you go ahead and register here at Texas Lutheran in case Louisiana State University Law School should be full, and you know, you just waste a semester. And so I decided, well, I'd go ahead and register at Texas Lutheran. I paid all my fees. 2 hours later, I went over, checked the mail, and there was a letter from Louisiana State University saying, come. During that semester that I had, and since I had already paid my fees, I decided to go ahead and stay a semester at Texas Lutheran. During that semester, I really took a hard look at what I would have to study in law school. And I studied the catalog extensively. And I studied that I was going to have to take courses in contracts, in torts, in taxes, in corporation law. And I thought, that looks boring. And so I sent for a seminary catalog. And I asked my wife after a while, after I had mulled it over in my mind, the seminary catalog looked tremendously exciting. Said, would you mind being a pastor's wife instead of being a rich attorney's wife? And she didn't hesitate. She said, you know, when I married you, I married you, and I didn't marry an occupation. And she said, if you feel like you want to go to seminary, head for seminary. I'd thought about it before. I know that I could have been a successful attorney. If I would leave the ministry today, I know I could go back to law school if my interests were there, and graduate and be a successful attorney. I know that right now, if for some reason I wanted to leave the ministry and go into being a full-time coin dealer, that the coin dealership that I have built up in Odessa, Texas, could support me and my family. And I am a minister today, not because I only have one vocation in life. And I preach the gospel with a freedom and with an abandon, and I am free to be the prophet, priest, and king of our church and Lutheran Church of the Risen Lord because I am not dependent on the income that I make from the church to be a minister of the gospel. I am free to preach the gospel, free to preach the gospel as God proclaims it to me in His Word, because I am not locked into ministry and I am not locked into that occupation. If the coin shop falls through, if my ministry falls through, I can always rely on my training as a bartender and become a bartender. And I used to be a good bartender at the restaurant. And I can always fall back on that. I wondered about my abilities as a bartender. I would come home from college during the summer and head for behind the bar, work behind the bar until 6, 7 o'clock, and then work as a cashier, and then go back to bartending, except after I had finished my stint as a cashier, I usually bartended for myself and for my friends. But I knew I was a fairly decent bartender, and I could knew how to mix all the drinks that were then popular. And I've kept up with mixed drinks, and although I don't drink too much myself anymore, I've maintained an interest in it, so I can always fall back on that. I wondered about my ability because there were two elderly gentlemen who used to come in every day about 11 o'clock when we'd open the restaurant, and they'd sit at the bar, and usually my mother's cousin who worked at the restaurant attended bar very early while I did other things in preparation for the opening of the restaurant, opening of the kitchen. These two gentlemen came in one day, and my mother's cousin was back in the kitchen doing something, and I asked these gentlemen if I could help them, and they said, is Mabel here today? And I said, yeah, Mabel's in the back. Can I help you with something? And they said, no, they'd wait for Mabel. And it kind of made me scratch my head, kind of, you know, a senior pastor and a junior pastor kind of thing, you know.
where they don't want the junior pastor, they want to talk to a senior pastor in a congregation. And so time passed, and it was about 11:30, and these gentlemen were still sitting at the bar and hadn't been waited on. And I said, are you sure I can't help you? And they said, no, we'll wait for Mabel. And Mabel was a buxom lady, rather well endowed, and time passed on. It was almost noon, and still they hadn't been waited on. I was anxious, you know, anxious to please the customer like I had always been trained to do. And so I said, Mabel has taught me how to mix drinks. I said, I can make a drink just as good as Mabel can. And they said, yeah, but you don't shake the way Mabel does. two dirty old men at the bar. But I know that there are other things that I can do in life. And I feel very comfortable and very relaxed with my vocation as a pastor, my vocation as a coin dealer, and other vocations that I'll branch out into. I probably will sell a coin shop in a not too distant future. Not because I've lost my interest in being a professional coin dealer, but because I can make a killing on the coins that I've bought over years. I have not taken one penny of profit from the coin shop. I've turned it all into inventory. And so my net worth has increased in 4 years from about $25,000 to close to $250,000 in 4 years. And I intend to retire at the age of 40 from the active ministry, from the paid ministry of the church, and donate my services to the church. And I think that that's an exciting prospect for me, to be a pastor without pay. And as long as my manager at the coin shop holds out, then I think in 6 more years, when I reach the age of 40, I think I'll be able to reach my goal and have the coin shop pay me a salary and be on the staff of a church, or maybe a free staff, a free ministry within the city of Odessa without having to be paid. And that's an exciting prospect for me. There's one other aspect of being a businessman that for you and for me is a tremendous advantage, and that is that the government gives certain tax advantages to businesses that they do not give to individuals. And so there's a lot of equipment that I've wanted to buy that I have been able to buy through my coin shop and make use of myself and use these things as a tax write-off, take a depreciation on these things. I have not paid any income taxes other than Social Security taxes in the last 4 years. I've operated the coin shop at a paper loss, even though I've increased my inventory, and so it's been a tremendous legal tax advantage for me. And as far as I know, I may wind up someday in Leavenworth, Kansas, but my accountant says that everything I've been doing has been perfectly legal. And so that's been one of the tremendous side aspects of being a coin dealer for me. Okay.
I do not know how to put a price tag on things. I work part-time at the University of Washington, and it's about 3.5 to 4 weeks each quarter, which is ideal, and I would like to do it full-time, and it also gives me the time in between that I can do what I really like to do, and that's arts and crafts.
Yes.
And I've done a lot in the past years, in nursing homes and my home, but I just don't know how, I just don't like to sell it, I guess. And people say, you must be crazy, why don't you sell it?
Uh-huh.
I like to give it away, but I do have mixed feelings. I really don't know. I would like the idea of maybe too to have the money. I'm not that pure, but
yeah.
I like the idea of giving it away even much more so.
Sure.
And I think the area of arts and crafts, it's hard, I feel it's hard to
put a price tag on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I find this in the coin shop too, that I try to encourage people to collect coins, and profit is not my main motive, although it is one of my motives in owning a coin shop. And to youngsters who are just beginning coin collecting, we sell youngsters many coins below cost, just to stimulate an interest in coin collecting. And I, too, take great
there's a great satisfaction in helping people to enjoy life and in helping them enjoy an avocation like coin collecting.
I would do it probably if I had to.
Yes.
I mean, that's another aspect. I'm just very fortunate to have a husband, and we get along just fine in
Yeah. Okay.
And I think it would be probably, if I had to, I think maybe...
It could be a very good source of second income for you. Arts and crafts, they're very popular today. Pricing, I would figure the amount of time that it takes you to make a specific thing. If it takes 2 hours, I would figure your time maybe at a standard workman's wage for a skilled artisan. Maybe five to maybe what figure what a plumber makes an hour. And
but this is a business thing that comes along with it that I lack, I guess.
Yes.
You see, I don't really have that.
And then price it either at a businessman's wage or figure a standard minimum wage time that it takes you and then price it 40% above that. 40% is a pretty standard markup in a lot of businesses. If you're dealing in jewelry, markup on a retail basis is 50%. In other words, if you buy something, gold jewelry that we handle in a coin shop, I do this as a service for people in the congregation, people in the community. If a man wants to buy his wife a nice pendant, and he doesn't want a gold-filled pendant, but he wants a good jewelry-type pendant, there's a keystone price. And a keystone price means that if a wholesaler buys it for $24, he sells it for $48. If he buys it for $100, he sells it for $200. So it's one of the services that I perform, for people in the congregation in particular, when I get an item like that, I've got a catalog. I don't carry any expensive jewelry in inventory. Tell them you pick it out the catalog, cut the price in half. I'll make a phone call, a toll-free phone call, get the item for you, and send you the invoice. And that way, I don't have to pay taxes on it. You don't have to pay taxes on it because it's an out-of-state purchase. And that's worked out tremendously. But 40 to 50% markup over your time would be a good thing, a good way of figuring how to price an individual object. I'd be interested in hearing some of your avocations, your hobbies, and maybe we could have some discussion on how it could be developed into a second career. You find a market. And if you've got a market, and if you've got a marketable product, then you've got, if you don't have capital to operate, a bank will capitalize an operation that they think will be successful. And you can take a proposition to a banker, and if it's a reasonable proposition, he'll capitalize for you. And so there's that way. And then operation. There are many ways that a small operation can be turned into a large operation, starting out with a mail order business. In almost every field, specific field has trade journals. In coin collecting, there are two weekly newspapers. One weekly newspaper dealing specifically with foreign coins. Then several magazine-type publications which are published monthly that you can buy on newsstands. If I were going to start again and didn't have the opportunity to buy a coin shop, then I would start a mail-order operation out of one of these trade journals, maybe starting out in the classified ads, which would run you maybe $8 to $10 a month. And then as your operation grew, begin to operate on a larger scale with a larger advertising budget, and one of the best places to advertise if you're going to do it locally is in the yellow pages of telephone book. That I found to be the best form of advertising for me. What are some of your hobbies that maybe you might be thinking about as a second career or just as a hobby right now?
Well, second careers are not a hobby.
That's a live possibility. Sure it is.
I'm on my fifth one.
You're on your...
I started in telephone management work. Went into public utility superintendent, high voltage line work, city manager work.
Mm-hmm.
And then into nursing home administration. Mm-hmm. Plus I've been a plumber, an electrician, and then a carpenter.
Wow. That's great. What are you working at now?
Nursing home administrator.
Nursing home administrator.
And also a licensed administrator.
That's tremendous.
He isn't rich yet.
And he isn't rich yet.
I think he is rich.
Yeah. I think the satisfaction that I've gotten from my occupation, both of my occupations, has been much, much more than the monetary rewards I've reaped from them. So I think you are a rich person. You bet. That's the most important thing, that you enjoy it. Not necessarily. Yeah, I bet he is.
Security.
Yeah.
You know that you can, if you miss on one, you can go to another.
You bet. You bet. Absolutely. I think that that's tremendous, and that's a tremendous feeling to know that you are successful in many things. And I think that's something that a lot of people lack today, is the confidence that you have, and that confidence is worth an awful lot, tremendous amount.
When I retire in 2 years, I'm going to do something different again.
Yeah, sure. When I sell my coin shop, I intend to get into something else. My hobby is not coins anymore. My hobby is model trains. And I'll probably do something in model trains. For a pastor, I would suggest that if you're interested in starting a second career, start a second career so that you're not in competition with anyone else in the community. This is where a coin shop has been good for me, because I've got a monopoly within probably maybe a 3,000 square mile area in West Texas. I'm a monopoly. And we're 120 miles to north, 140 miles north to Lubbock, 120 miles east to Abilene, 600 miles southeast to San Antonio, and 250 miles west to El Paso. And I have the monopoly in that area.
You spoke of law school 5 years ago. I was all set to go to law school. Then I was transferred to a large facility and really didn't have the time.
Is that right?
But I missed one more. I was a life insurance salesman also.
Ah. How about your hobbies? Norm, what's your hobby?
I have a real strong interest in photography. I've taken a lot of, well, several courses, and I display it in the office proudly. And, you know, I think a lot of it is good enough, take a certain amount of pride in it, that I could, you know, enter it in contests or sell it. But I just enjoy doing it.
Uh-huh.
And so I can identify with you. I just enjoy getting out and taking the pictures. I have done one little thing, though. One gets financial advantages, that my photography, I write it off for the office. I use it in the office.
That's right.
The patients enjoy it. I enjoy it. So I write that part of it.
Yeah.
Glasses, the film, and it doesn't amount to much, but it's there. You know.
My coin shop owns all my cameras, because I do use them for identifying coins, photograph them for people for insurance purposes. So I don't own a camera. Texas Coins owns a camera. I bought a Betamax system recently that I'm sure I will enjoy many of the Dallas Cowboys football games several times, and a lot of movies, and things that I don't get to see because of pastoral ministry I carry on, that I'll be able to enjoy now. Texas Coins owns that because they use it for security reasons down at the coin shop. I have visual proof on a videotape that such and such coin was in inventory on such and such a date. It would take me maybe an hour to do my inventory on videotape, where it would take days to do it by hand. So, advantages like that.
One of my biggest rewards I felt through all the years that and I had classes in various fields like macrame and stitchery and all that, was to convince people that everybody is creative.
Absolutely.
I had this background from back home. I went to a college of sort of home economics and art, and we were really trained to do our own thing, and some of that stayed with me. And I think the market here in this country is so much with kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, paint by number. I hope I'm not
insulting anyone,
hurting anybody's feeling who has done this. To me, that's a therapy that might be used in hospitals
mm-hmm.
or so. But I think that also our advertisement is really underestimating people's creativity, and that makes me so mad. And
mm-hmm.
I really have fought for this, and I've had many rewards where people really realize that they can do it instead of copying something. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you show them the technique, and then they should do their own thing.
Yeah.
And I think that was my nicest thing in all of them.
I think that's tremendous. I really do. When I was here at Holden the first time, I decided to paint, and I had never painted before. And I sat up above lodge number, whatever it is, right up here, I've forgotten the number, 2, and painted a watercolor of the tailings and of Copper Mountain and Buckskin and the saddle. And it was just tremendous. And I ran over and I showed it to Carol Hinderly, and he said, "You mean this is your first painting?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Gee, I thought it was your second." But we started a thing at our church called a craft morning, and it's Monday mornings, isn't it, Carol? My wife up there, Carol. When women can come and just strictly have a morning of crafts. We've had women in to do needlepoint. We've had classes in acrylics painting. There's absolutely no religious pretext to it at all, just people who enjoy getting together and being creative. And we're going to take back the idea of the Inkaloom.
It also creates confidence.
Yes.
I think from that many other things come. Feeling worth is very important.
Before you all leave, I want to give you a token from my coin shop. These are 1 of 1,000. And I'll pass them around. I had them made for the shop. This and a quarter will buy you a cup of coffee in any Sambo's or any Denny's in the country. They are part of a series that was produced last year as part of the bicentennial by a company called the Patrick Mint. They made approximately 1,000 of these for coin businesses and for businessmen, and they will be a collectible item. They're putting out a book of their tokens and people that they manufactured them for, and it's also got my coin shop name, address, in case you should ever want to buy a coin or a coin shop.
I'm glad you're giving something away too.
Yeah. And we have 1,000 of them made, and I own specific rights to those dies. They can never make another one without my permission. And so it's a very collectible item. It's made out of copper. And if the copper mine here was still in production, you could say it might be copper that came from the Holden mine.
That's
right. Copper that came in here poor, we're going to go away rich.
That's right. That's right.
Where did you get your copper for that? Did you buy it from
the mint made them.
Oh, you had
them
made by?
I had them made by the Patrick Mint in California.
Oh.
And they provided the dies. On one side, it's got Independence Hall. And believe it or not, I lucked out. That was the design that was used least last year by the Patrick Mint, was the Independence Hall obverse die. And so that's the most collectible of the obverse dies. Be happy to answer any.
Thank you.
You're
yeah,
welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Is it right that coins of any kind lose their value if you incorporate them into, let's say, jewelry or something? Isn't that true?
No, not necessarily.
I have some old German coins that were put into a bracelet.
It depends on if they were soldered in or punctured. I carry a $20 gold piece and a money clip, and it's not hurt at all. It's just with a bent in type of thing. Y'all would like to take a look at some coins. I did a little talk a couple days ago on some ancient coins, and then I've got some U.S. gold and some foreign gold coins in here. And if you've never seen a $20 gold piece or a 50 peso piece or held an ancient coin, just come on up and I'll...
Do you trade any political buttons?
Yeah. Do you collect political buttons?
Yeah, I'm one of three people in our area who do that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I've got a button of an... Here's an ancient coin. That's the Emperor Caligula had that particular coin made. And if you look closely, a central figure here is Caligula. He stands taller than everybody else.
How did you find that?
I bought it from a coin dealer in New York. There's a wholesale market in coins as well as a retail market.
Uh-huh.
And that's piety on reverse. And Caligula is about to sacrifice an ox on the front. See, here's Caligula. And there's an altar. The ox has its foot over the altar. And there's the ox with the head with the horns on it. Someone's holding the ox. Caligula's about to sacrifice it. And that's the temple of Jupiter Capitolinus. With a four-horse rig on top of it. You can see the facade of the temple. It's really a miniature work of art.
Got so much.
What
do you call it? Why do you call it double eagle?
The standard U.S. gold coin, when we first started producing gold coins in 1793, was a $10 gold piece. That dates from 37 to 41 A.D. So it's approximately 1900 years old. I've got one here that dates back, and this is a denarius. It dates back even farther. This one dates back to approximately 125 B.C. And this particular coin is very interesting. It's got the head of Mercury on the front, but on the back it tells the story of Ulysses returning home from the Odyssey. And he came home dressed as an old beggar, and his dog was the only one that recognized him.
How do you dare carry this stuff around?
Oh, it's very easy. Just carry it around, yeah.
These are just, you have one of this particular
coin? Yes, I have one of that particular coin.
You carry it around?
Sure. This is, if you want to see what Augustus Caesar looked like, he was a Caesar who reigned from 29 B.C. to 14 A.D. and was Caesar Augustus who gave the decree that all the world should be enrolled in Luke chapter 2. That's a very accurate portrait of Augustus. And so that dates from the time of Christ. That's approximately 125 A.D. And then here's...
Did you know these coins existed, or did you just happen to come across them and found them?
I have... There are books that list ancient coins, some fairly extensive books. This is Nero, the famous and infamous Nero. And that's a large bronze called a sesterce. And then these are $20 gold pieces. Theodore Roosevelt wanted to make a coin that rival the coins of Greece in their beauty. Romans were very accurate in their portraiture. Greeks were artistic in their coins. And St. Gaudens designed this coin, which is beautiful, when he made it in 1907. And you can notice on the back that he did not put the U.S. motto, "In God We Trust," on the coins. And there was such a public furor raised that in 1908 he was forced to put "In God We Trust" on the coins. And so one has it and one doesn't. One is a 1907 model and the other is a 1915 model. But he changed the design in 1908.
So the 1907 is very rare.
Not really. It'll command a premium, $50 to $60.